I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
One continuing question in any election year is, how's the economy doing? With consumer spending down last month and housing construction down too, the Senate Banking Committee will be listening carefully this afternoon to Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. Most economists say the country is in the midst of an economic recovery. And last month, the Fed raised interest rates for the first time in 4 years in an attempt to head off inflation. Well, joining us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia is Mark Zandi, chief economist for economy.com. Hi, Mark.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And let's talk first about what we might expect from Alan Greenspan. Always a difficult thing to predict, I assume. But the matter of interest rates, which the Fed raised in June as a hedge against inflation, is that enough to keep inflation in check?
Well, he'll have to do more interest rate hikes. This is only the beginning. I do expect the Federal Reserve to tighten policy, raise interest rates on a consistent basis over the course of the next couple of years. If they follow through on that, I do think that inflation will remain in check and the economy will be just fine.
Let's talk a moment about the housing construction numbers. Down in June to the lowest level in just over a year, wasn't isolated. It fell across the country. What kind of impact does that have on the economy?
I wouldn't worry too much about that. The housing market's still quite strong. Interest rates have moved up a bit, but broadly speaking, housing's still strong. I don't think I'd read too much into those housing statistics. But if interest rates do push up more, and I would anticipate that happening, that we will see housing weakening to some degree.
Well, Mark, what about some of the other numbers for June? Jobs were up, but the gain was smaller than in May, and retail sales fell. Any cause for worry there?
No. June was a tough month, no doubt. A lot of the data we've been getting in the last few weeks for the month of June have looked on the soft side. But it's still growing. The economy is still moving forward. The expansion's intact. And in all likelihood, the economy will continue to expand for the foreseeable future.
I'm sure you saw an article in today's Wall Street Journal that says, so far, the economic recovery has been tilting toward the highest income Americans. Is that worrisome that there is that kind of divide between who's doing well these days and who isn't?
Yes, that is a problem. The economy is growing. It is expanding. But it is a bit disappointing that we're not seeing even better growth. And because of that, certain groups within our economy aren't doing particularly well, particularly lower middle income households. They're still struggling. We can see that in a lot of different ways. The retailers that are doing well are high-end retailers. The cars that are being sold are high-end cars. You can see it in the wage and income data. You can see it in the financial statistics. Bankruptcy filings are still very high. Mortgage foreclosure rates are still very high. So there is a divide, I do think, between upper middle income households and lower middle income households.
Which would probably also explain a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll in late June that found that 45% of Americans approved of how the Bush administration has handled the economy and 49% did not.
There you go. That explains it. I do think people in the bottom half of the income distribution are having a very difficult time, and I suspect they will continue to have a difficult time going forward.
Well, overall, in looking at the economic figures that you see, reason for caution but not concern?
That's a good way to put it. I think we should be optimistic that the economy is moving forward. We're past the worst of the dark days of the last few years, and the economy is growing, expanding. It's creating jobs. It's self-sustaining. All good news. But caution. There's still risks, and caution because it's still all a bit disappointing. The economy isn't growing fast enough to really bring in all the people who have been unemployed, underemployed for so long.
Mark, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mark Zandi is chief economist for economy.com. He spoke to us from Philadelphia.
In Iraq, an unintended consequence of the fall of Saddam Hussein has been the loss of the rights of women. One pointed illustration of that fact, an increase in honor killings, the murder of women by family members who suspect that they've strayed from traditional values. Vivian Walt has written about the spike in honor killings for this week's Times Magazine. She joins us from Baghdad. Vivian, there were such killings under Saddam Hussein. What's different now?
Well, there does seem to have been an increase, and it's happened sort of somewhat surprisingly. In fact, I myself was rather surprised to find it. I mean, if you think that really there have been thousands of American military police stationed inside Iraqi police stations for many, many months, this has nonetheless gone on at a higher rate than before the war.
Yeah, you write that the number of victims, although it's hard to tell, but they may total in the hundreds as compared to neighboring countries where there might be 20 honor killings a year. And the secular Saddam Hussein even signed a directive authorizing women's rights. So what is the connection between his fall and the rise of killings?
Essentially, law and order generally had broken down since the war. I mean, it's gotten a little better in recent weeks, but for, you know, more than a year after the war, people could get away with violent crimes of all kinds, this being one of them. This has become a much more violent place and a place where essentially you can literally get away with murder.
And perhaps some of it religious-based, which might not have been allowed under his regime?
Indeed. I mean, the religious sheikhs are certainly much more powerful than they were before. People have, in a way, gone back to depending on tribal laws in the vacuum that was created for many months after the war. There was, you know, very little justice system, law and order system that really continued without a big impact.
You write that there's a virginity testing room in Baghdad's Forensics Institute where women are brought and doctors examine them to see, in fact, if they are no longer virgins, and that might seal their fate. Can you tell us, you know, one of the stories of what's happened to at least one of these women?
Well, boy, I could tell you many stories. For example, I was in a police station where somebody had come in a few weeks before to confess that he had just murdered his wife. The police officers let him walk out alone of the police station, saying that it wasn't inside their precinct. The other story, for example, a 16-year-old girl left home for a few days. Her brothers went and found her in the street, brought her back home, and one shot her several times in the living room. The parents actually requested that the brother not be prosecuted, but the police decided to send him to the judge and to get him prosecuted, and he was given a year in jail, eligible for parole after a few months. Yeah. And so on. The stories really are numerous.
Is there any sense in the few seconds that we have, Vivian, that the new government might put a stop to these honor killings?
Well, the one sign of hope is that the interim constitution, at least, has a 25% quota for women representatives. And many of these women that I've spoken to have come back from abroad. They're here with sort of new ideas, fresh energy, back from years as refugees. And they say they're determined to take on this issue. And they want these men convicted as common murderers. Of course, you know, they have a huge uphill battle in front of them.
Vivian Walt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Vivian Walt is a reporter for Time Magazine. For more on her report on the increase of honor killings in Iraq, go to our website, here-now.org.
After 2 years without a contract, the city of Boston and its police force have been ordered to binding arbitration to resolve their dispute by Thursday. That decision came yesterday as the city gets ready to welcome the Democratic National Convention next week. Police officers have been threatening to picket dozens of convention events. Well, WBUR's Audie Cornish is on that story, and she joins us now from downtown Boston. And Audie, two things are happening today. The Patrolmen's Association was in court, and then later today they get to tell their side of the story to the arbitrator. So first off, what happened in court this morning?
Well, earlier today, the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, it's one of the city's largest unions, basically went to a superior court to ask the judge for a preliminary injunction, meaning they were asking the court to please stop this arbitration process from taking place. The reasons they gave were, one, the compressed nature of the arbitration. When they first heard or were first ordered, they had a week. And suddenly, at the meeting yesterday, they were told they basically had 48 hours to put together a case in a process that normally takes 7 months. They also argue that they were not being given due process because of this compression of time. Meanwhile, the state, which argued on behalf of the labor committee that made this vote, said that, you know, we've been talking about ordering arbitration for months. We've known for months that negotiations haven't been going well. You knew this was coming. You should have been prepared. Moreover, they argue that the technicalities that the union was trying to press in court were just that, technicalities, and that a superior court judge shouldn't get involved in what this joint labor management committee was doing because they know best. And in the end, the judge agreed, mainly because of what the city has been citing all along. She said that the union was not just taking to court a public entity, but also a public entity that is charged in some way with dealing with the public interest. And by that, she meant the DNC. The DNC, the Democratic National Convention, is coming next week, and many people from the Attorney General to the City of Boston have said that if police officers have their time divided between picketing and policing, it could wear down public security.
So then if this does get resolved by Thursday, which it has to, will there still be police pickets out there, whether they are Boston police officers or officers from other communities around the state?
If you talk to the Police Patrolmen's Association today, they will say yes, and they have been saying yes for several days. They say that, you know, it's not just them who are involved here. There are other unions who are still out contracts right now, and they'll be there in support of them. And they also say that they, you know, the whole process, they think, is sort of a sham. They feel railroaded. And they really, as they say, as the president, Tom Sinise, said this morning, said this is about respect. And so we're seeing things get personal, and I think that they're going to be out in force this weekend at the early events of the Democratic National Convention, picketing, even if that means they're picketing with contract in hand.
And what's that going to mean overall in terms of security for the National Convention next week? They're expecting, what, about 35,000 people to be here? It's a complicated situation anyway, even without this.
And that's the exact argument that the state and the city of Boston have been making. They're saying that we're anticipating thousands of protesters. Boston has never had a political convention before. It generally has a small police force compared to other cities that have held conventions in the past and so have been supplementing with state police, National Guard, small regional police affiliations. And so already people are going to be working 12, 16-hour shifts to make this work. So it's hard to say what will happen. The police say we have been picketing for the last 6 months without any without jeopardizing the public safety. This concern is a red herring.
All right, Audie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gail.
WBUR's Audie Cornish joined us on the line from downtown Boston.
Just ahead, a reporter's notebook on life in a remote region of Pakistan.
And later in the program, a legal battle may be coming to an end over the fate of the 9,000-year-old skeleton known as Kennewick Man.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
U.S. troops continue to prowl the mountains of eastern Afghanistan in search of al-Qaeda fighters and Osama bin Laden himself. But just over the border, inside Pakistan, lies the remote tribal region of Waziristan, where al-Qaeda fighters drift in and out beyond the reach of American and Pakistani forces. Rumors swirl. The latest is that bin Laden has replaced his foreign bodyguards with local Waziri woodcutters to escape the notice of the American satellites peering down. Eliza Griswold is a writer for the New York Magazine, and in this week's issue, she describes her travels in Waziristan. Welcome, Eliza.
Thank you.
First of all, can you describe this area that we're talking about? How does it feel? What does it look like?
In a way, a futuristic There's something Mad Maxian about what it's like to travel in Waziristan. And I think, you know, one understands what it is to be entering a warlord's territory, basically. You know, I mean, where security breaks down, wherever one might be, in Liberia or Congo. But this is so profound because what you have literally as the only structures there are remnants of British forts, which are now inhabited by Pakistani troops. Then you have these houses, which literally are crenellated. I mean, you are looking at fortresses, and this is how the wazirs live. And the only other structure are these madrasas, which obviously teach a variety of forms of Islam, some of them frightening, and they are the only strains of color in this landscape, and that is incredibly powerful to me.
Mad Maxian,
it is. I mean, you definitely feel you might run into Genghis Khan in Converse, you know, charging you $5 billion to pass through his checkpoint, you know. You have these strange juxtapositions and modernity just literally riding in a big army truck through an area that didn't have a road before 6 months ago. So it's surreal.
And the people, the wazirs, you write that no foreign invader from Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan to the British Empire has ever been able to control them. Tell us more about the people.
The people are complicated, as all people are. They are fiercely independent. They are warriors. They like to fight with each other. They really do get bored and start feuds over just about anything. Land, gold, and women are the sort of old-time causes for conflict. They're very intelligent people. They're very well informed these days. I mean, they have, you know, BBC Pashto service, which runs throughout their region. And, you know, when Sheikh Yassin is killed and any other Hamas leader is killed, they get angry and they feel very much part of a global community. And I think that's important to remember.
And one in particular you write about, Khalid Wazir, pronounce his title.
He is the Khan Bahadur of 30,000 people in North Waziristan, which comprises three tribes. And these tribes are the tribes in North Waziristan most accused of harboring al-Qaeda.
He had a terrific response, by the way, to that accusation. You write that because he's got this title of leader of these people, he sort of, everybody assumes that he knows where Osama bin Laden is, and he has a response to that?
He says many funny things about it. One in particular is he says, you know, I'm the Khan Bahadur, I'm the chief. I know where Osama bin Laden is. George Bush is the leader of the entire United States. He was elected by Florida, and he knew there were terrorists training in Florida. So, you know, I mean, I think that level of savvy is something we really need to come to understand. It's very easy at a distance to think of, oh, the fierce and wily tribesmen in an area we simply can't penetrate. But that's too easy.
Which brings us back to the main question that everyone asks, that they ask of Khalid Wazir, that there's an assumption that people know who's harboring Osama bin Laden and where he is. Mm-hmm. And you visited Shawal, is that how you pronounce it?
Shawal, yeah.
Shawal, the isolated area where it's thought that he is hiding.
Mm-hmm.
Having seen the area, meeting these people, do you think he is there? And do you think they are harboring him?
Any answer to that question would be far too speculative for me to even attempt. Do I think there's al-Qaeda, a strong al-Qaeda presence in the region? Absolutely.
A couple questions. We were really mm-hmm. struck reading your article about how much we've forgotten about this part of the world, where, mm-hmm. in fact, you know, the war on terrorism was headed and suddenly redirected to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
What have you seen happen there, perhaps because the focus was taken off Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Well, one thing that's happened, and this is, you know, I had multiple reports of this, is that because after a lot of battles in Afghanistan, fighters would make their way through North Waziristan, South Waziristan, Balochistan, and then out through Quetta. And where would they go? They went to Iraq. And that, that I think, helps to understand, my gosh, we really have created this problem in Iraq, whereas people who would have stayed home actually left Afghanistan to go fight in Iraq. And that, to me, was mind-blowingly simple, but also incredibly powerful.
You write, at one point you were watching a convoy of the Pakistan military, and mm-hmm. you said it was, the army swarming over inhospitable land to battle an invisible enemy among tribesmen who grew increasingly enraged.
Mm-hmm.
How angry are the Wazirs at this search for al-Qaeda in their area?
They are so incredibly furious, it's difficult to overstate the degree of their anger. I mean, the first time I was in Waziristan was October 7th, 2001, the day the U.S. launched airstrikes against Afghanistan. So to have been there in the fury of that moment, which was certainly heated, to now, it's profoundly disturbing the degree to which we have radicalized a population which used to look at the U.S. as, you know, a great source of, oh, let's all go, let's get visas and go, and that is no longer the case.
Eliza, thank you so much.
Thank you.
New Yorker magazine writer Eliza Griswold on Waziristan in Pakistan.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, one man's story about making ends meet by going to work.
And it's a white man's world. That's the finding of a new survey about who gets to direct television shows. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The number of Medicare patients with Alzheimer's shot up by 250% during the 1990s, so says a study presented this week at the 9th International Conference on Alzheimer's Disease. Several studies at the conference look at the healthcare implications of Alzheimer's, which Steve McConnell calls the public health crisis of the 21st century. McConnell is the Alzheimer's Association Senior Vice President for Advocacy and Public Policy, and he joins us now. Steve, welcome.
Thank you, Gail.
How do you account for that? It sounds like a staggering number, 250% increase. Is it just because there are more aging people now?
More people living longer. The double-edged sword. On the one hand, medical science and better health care and better nutrition allows people to live longer. The downside of that is more and more people are developing Alzheimer's disease. And as we look into the future, as this huge baby boom cohort comes along, those numbers will become astronomical, and simply the healthcare system can't handle it.
Well, they already seem astronomical among African Americans. That number is, what, 450%?
Right.
And how do you account for that?
Well, some of that is that we're now recognizing the disease. We're better able to diagnose it, so it may have been there before, but we can now diagnose people earlier. At the same time, we're seeing the increased association between some problems of heart disease, blood pressure, and so forth that contribute to Alzheimer's disease. So those tend to be higher in minority populations, and so we're starting to see the evidence of that now in expressions of Alzheimer's disease.
You characterize the projections going forward as astronomical. Any sense of how astronomical?
Well, there are now 4.5 million people in the U.S. that have Alzheimer's disease. Unless we find a way to prevent this disease or head it off, slow it down, we're going to see as many as 11 to 16 million by the middle of the century.
Mm-hmm.
And that translates directly into very high health care costs.
Sure, which means what? I mean, what can we do about it?
The Alzheimer's Association is calling on Congress to fund Alzheimer's research at $1 billion a year. Sounds like a lot, but we're now spending $680 million, so it's just a couple hundred million more. And with that, the scientists are very confident that we'll be able to at least delay the onset of this disease, slow its progression, perhaps prevent it. And if we can do that, within 5 years of a breakthrough, we could save $50 billion a year in Medicare costs alone. But if we don't invest, we're going to see these enormous costs that we simply won't be able to handle.
Well, in the meantime, Steve, are there things that we can do now, people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, to reduce the risk of getting Alzheimer's at some point?
As a matter of fact, Gail, there are. Simply managing your numbers, watching your weight, exercising both your body and your brain, maintaining a better blood pressure and keeping your cholesterol under control, managing diabetes, all those things which are good for your heart appear to also be good for your head. So those are things that people can do now.
Well, that certainly is encouraging news, Steve. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Steve McConnell is Senior Vice President for Advocacy and Public Policy for the Alzheimer's Association.
The legal battle over Kennewick Man may finally be at an end. When the 9,000-year-old skeleton was discovered on the banks of the Columbia River in Washington state, scientists were thrilled by the prospect of studying the unusually well-preserved remains. But local Indian tribes claimed the bones were those of a revered ancestor and demanded that they be reinterred. So the scientists sued to prevent that. The legal battle continued for years, and even after a ruling in favor of the scientists, the prospect of a Supreme Court appeal still loomed. But Monday, the Umatilla, the last tribe holding out for an appeal, voted against continuing the case. Doug Owsley is a forensic anthropologist at the Smithsonian and one of the original plaintiffs. Dr. Owsley, your thoughts now that you might finally get to examine the skeleton?
Well, the scientists involved in this case are very pleased. It is an exceedingly important skeleton. Skeletons from this time period are very rare, and they can tell us a lot about life during that time period. And by examining the skeleton, I think, for one thing, we will have a much better understanding of how the skeleton came to be in the location that it was discovered.
You have already seen the skeleton and are quoted as saying that he may not be a North American Indian at all. So where would he have come from? How would he get there?
Well, when you look at the history books in the last decades, for one thing, it talks about people coming to the New World and coming across the Bering Land Bridge and coming across about 13,500 years ago. And as we begin to study these ancient skeletons, for one thing, we realize that it's much more complicated than that, and it seems to be telling us a story of multiple migrations over a much longer time period. And some of the very first people that get into the New World have features that are very different from what we see in later American Indian skeletons. And one of the things that we can do in answering the question as to where this individual came from is we take specific measurements to describe the shape of the skull, how long it is, how broad it is, different facial measurements, and we can relate that to different world populations for which we have this kind of data.
Who do you think he is?
Well, if I were to say based on other ancient skeletons that I've looked at, I think that he's going to fall within the type of people that we see along the coastal Pacific areas, such as coastal Japan, ancestors, for instance, of a people that we call the Ainu. And the ancestors of the Ainu, if you go back in time, are referred to, identified as the Jomon culture. And I think that that particular culture you can track back in Japan, for instance, some 10,000 years. And I think that those are the descendants of some of the very first Upper Paleolithic people into Asia.
Well, we found ourselves asking so many questions, and I'll ask them of you. Did he come by boat? Did the lands used to be connected? Why was he alone? Where are the rest of them? Do you have any answers?
Well, we don't have all the answers, and that's why it's very important to study skeletons like this, because each one can add incrementally to what we know about this time period. I think the evidence is suggesting that people got into the New World much earlier than we had thought. It suggests that people are coming from different areas than what we had originally thought, that rather than by coming only across the Bering Land Bridge, that there were people that were coming by boats. And some of these people, for instance, as we're talking about with the ancestors of the Ainu going back thousands of years, that those were maritime hunter-gatherers, and some of those people were some of the first people to get into the New World. Mm. And we don't know right now what the relationship between these very early and very different-looking ancient skeletons and more recent people that, say, came 5,000 years ago and 6,000 years ago and in more recent time. Mm.
You write, we cannot know if he is truly anyone's ancestor. Given the millennia since he lived, he may be sire to none or all of us.
True.
Well, Dr. Owsley, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Doug Owsley from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C.
Still to come, an investigative journalist looks at the hidden lives of Catholic nuns in the United States.
You're listening to Here and Now.
One of the most important puzzles of modern physics, the black hole information paradox, may soon be resolved by noted physicist Stephen Hawking. For almost 30 years now, Hawking has argued that black holes swallow light and matter until nothing is left. Well, now he's saying he was wrong, that black holes may ultimately allow what's inside to escape. Hawking first presented his new findings a few weeks ago at a seminar in Cambridge, England, and he's expected to say more tomorrow when he speaks at the 17th International Conference on General Relativity and Gravitation in Dublin. Gary Gibbons, professor of theoretical physics at the University of Cambridge, was at the seminar where Hawking first provided a few details on his new theory, and Professor Gibbons joins us now on the phone. Hello, Professor.
Hello.
Now, you're a colleague of Stephen Hawking, so tell us a bit more about this seminar you attended. What did he say, and how did he present these new findings?
Well, it was a regular seminar, which he'd recorded because, as you know, he can't speak. The audience, I think, was slightly baffled, actually, because not many mathematical details were given during the seminar, and I'm not sure many more will be given at the conference.
Well, now, many people who, like me, may not know very much about physics, have at least heard of Stephen Hawking. His 1988 book, A Brief History of Time, was a bestseller. And his lecture at tomorrow's conference seems to be generating quite a bit of press attention. Is this, in the overall scheme of things, truly groundbreaking?
Well, I think it's an important step if what he says is right. He changed his mind, essentially, about something, and many people said that he was wrong in the first place. So those people, I think, won't change very much. But those that accepted the arguments that he propounded in the past, they'll, of course, have to decide whether they agree with the new arguments or stick to their old views. But one should see this as part of a bigger problem, which is to try and unify quantum mechanics and general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity. And this is a part of that structure, but it's by no means the final story. We shan't really know for sure until we have a properly mathematically formulated theory which we can then calculate with. So these are really indications on the way, I think, rather than the final answer.
Well, either way, is it fair to say that people will be on the edges of their seats tomorrow?
Oh, I think so, yes. They'll be especially interested because, as always, you know, if people say one thing and then change their mind and there's been a long debate, then, that adds further interest to what is, I think, a very interesting scientific question.
But ultimately, the world works the way the world works, right? And it's just our understanding of it that changes over time.
Well, that's true, but I think there's a more serious intent here. I mean, if we can't really understand the large-scale universe without understanding the laws of physics, so they have a consequence in that sense.
And it's certainly nothing new that scientists and physicists often revise and update their theories. Einstein did so. So just because Stephen Hawking is revising his, I take it, doesn't mean that he's not a good physicist.
No. I mean, he put forward a provocative proposal, which a lot of people thought, you know, wasn't justified by the evidence he had at the time, but it was a working hypothesis. It's a basis for a program of work, and I'm sure that's what he's going to do with his new ideas. That's how science progresses.
But you're looking for some real math tomorrow.
Well, I don't know if we'll get it tomorrow, but I think people will suspend judgment until they've seen, you know, a scientific paper, which will then be scrutinized in the usual way by referees and talked over by experts. That's really what counts in the end.
Well, Professor, thank you for helping us understand this a little better.
Not at all.
Gary Gibbons is Professor of Theoretical Physics at the University of Cambridge in Cambridge, England.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In 1965, there were 180,000 Catholic nuns in the U.S. Today, that number has dropped to 73,000. Little attention has been paid to this vanishing subculture, maybe because nuns who are cloistered are so hard to observe. Those who are modern are so hard to detect. Only 30% of nuns still wear the telltale black habits and stiff wimples. So who are these women, these sisters, who have given up sex, money, relationships with men to dedicate their lives to God? When investigative journalist Cheryl Reed was little, she was afraid of nuns but fascinated by them. And now Reed has turned that curiosity into a book, Unveiled: The Hidden Lives of Nuns. And she joins us in the studio to talk about the 5 years she spent getting to know hundreds of sisters in over 50 orders and communities across the country. And hello, Cheryl.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What was your fascination?
Well, growing up Protestant, I never met a nun. I never saw a nun other than on the street or at a gas station. And they were stern-looking because to people who aren't used to nuns and the habit, the habit can be a pretty scary dress.
Yeah, when the wind catches it. It is. It's sort of it's dark and spooky. What is it? What does it signify?
Well, typically today, what a habit signifies is that typically that order is a little more conservative and more traditional. The orders that are progressive kind of broke away from the habit. They wear little pins. Some of the older sisters will still wear a habit. But generally, anyone below 70 or even 80 these days will not wear a habit.
It was at one time the wedding gown?
And it still is to some sisters.
In the marriage to Christ?
Yes. And I have been to some of those ceremonies, and it does look like a wedding. And they do march down the aisle with a candle, and their habit is blessed, and then they put it on. So it's a very romantic notion. And initially, when they first got their habits, they adored them. They loved them. They prayed little vigils for every little piece. But then after a while, they got tired of this thing, and they really were looking forward to getting rid of it.
Well, now you're meeting nuns. I'm thinking of one, Pat, who wears a red slip.
Yeah.
Because she can.
Right.
And so I know you started this pilgrimage of your own to find out why women like Pat and others became nuns. Why did they?
There are several different reasons. One is that we're talking generations. Like in the 1940s and the 1950s, some of these women had very little opportunities. They could either become a nun, they could marry and have lots of kids, particularly if they were Catholic, or they could become a teacher. And for many of them who grew up in large families, particularly those who lived in rural communities, going to the convent basically was the only way they could get an education. That's the sort of the old model. The newer models, and the average age for the women entering today is 38. So the newer models are typically two different categories. One is a younger woman, typically in the early 20s, who is very conservative, wants the habit, wants the traditional lifestyle, and those orders are actually getting numbers of women. And then there's a second kind of woman entering today, and she's typically older, very educated, has had a successful career. A third of them have been married and have many of them have adult children. And those women, they feel like they've achieved everything the world said was valuable, and yet they weren't happy. And they feel that they want to give their lives to something of a higher calling. They want their work to mean something. And most importantly, they want to live with other women.
Yeah. You came across so many types of these women as well, some very social, some hermits, some conservative, others like I'm thinking of Benedictine Mother Superior Dawn, into Star Trek.
The mystic Mother Superior.
Yes. And some activist, Sister Margaret Traxler in Chicago. ran homeless shelters, you became very close to her.
I did. I spent often on the last 2 years of her life with her. She was a very controversial figure in the larger Catholic Church and also in Chicago. She put her name when an ad ran in the New York Times in 1984 in support of Geraldine Ferraro, saying that there are other Catholics who believe in abortion, similar to the situation we're having with Kerry, you know. And so this ad ran. 96 nuns signed their names and several priests. The priests were told to recant, which they did. The nuns refused. And she was one of those nuns. And she was very much pressured by the Vatican to recant by what she said, and she never would.
Yeah. This woman in particular, I mean, I think as a whole they all touched you, but this woman in particular did. How? Why?
I think there's this perception that if you're a religious woman, that you are a pushover, that you're meek and mild, and you're the church lady. And and she was not the church lady. I mean, she would just tell you what she thought.
Until she couldn't.
Until she couldn't. You know, when she had a stroke, you know, it sort of robbed her of the most important vehicle that she had, which was speaking.
Yeah.
I think what she said to me, which in her impact on me, was that in order to be a spiritual person, you don't have to give up your own conscience. You don't have to be a meek and mild person. And in fact, a really strong, devoted, passionate person speaks up.
I say this person touched you, and I was joking with you before we started speaking here that we almost lost you. You, for a while, you're married. Here you are, tough investigative reporter. And suddenly looking at your subject and thinking maybe you wanted to do this.
I always went through it with the idea that I knew that the normal woman could not do this. And I sort of saw myself as a spiritual connoisseur, that I was testing out each of these religious orders, trying to figure out, could I really do this? It was sort of a test of wills. Could the modern woman really do this? And also I think it was to discover whether I really had it. I could tell you I could do it. But I'm not sure I want to do it. Mm-hmm. And there would be certain criteria. I adored living with these women. There's just this camaraderie that you don't experience anywhere else.
Yeah. You even at one point adopted their way of dressing, very simply, black pants,
yes.
White shirt, to as you are now, come to think of it, to feel it, to try to feel it. But, you know, the thing that swirls around everyone is they think maybe they could be deeply spiritual for their life, but chastity. Do they talk to you about sex? Yeah.
All the time. In fact, they talk about sex a lot. And they talk about how they try to avoid those feelings and things like that and what they do when they get their days that they're really, you know, sexed up, you know.
Wait, did a nun actually use that phrase with you?
No, actually she said horny, but I don't know if we can say that on air. Anyway, when they get those days, they talk about it. They go play tennis. They try to share it with each other. Hmm. And then there are some orders that you're not allowed to talk about it. But increasingly, women are encouraged to talk about it because it's one way of relieving that stress and knowing that other women are going through it.
You wrote your book and spent your 5 years doing this research before the current crisis in the Catholic Church.
Yeah. I actually worked for a year before I started this project. I spent a year traveling around the country and actually did several pieces on Boston priests. These were priests who had left the church and were married, some of them secretly, some of them openly, and they lost their pensions and support from the church. And so I spent a year doing this, traveling around the country, and so I knew a lot of priests. I found them to be very lonely, and many of them. And I expected to find the same things when I turned my attention to the nuns, and that's not what I found. Actually, I found them to be very happy and very satisfied. So when the priest pedophilia stuff broke, largely in Boston and other areas, the sisters felt that they were kind of getting a black eye because they really are totally separate from the hierarchy of the church. The church does not support them. They don't give them money. They don't give them land, retirement. They're really their own entity. They do have to have their institutions okayed by the Vatican, but largely that's just a bureaucratic process.
This may seem too simple and a conclusion, but it sounds as if the Catholic Church isn't playing to its strengths.
Oh, absolutely, which is at the ending of my book, as I say, this is the secret church that the church could really build on, but they're not interested in hearing about women.
Well, Cheryl Reed, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cheryl Reed is an investigative reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. Her new book is called Unveiled, The Hidden Lives of Nuns. Thank you.
Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Kako, Karen Miller-Metzen, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo. And our interns are Nick Weiss-Richmond, Alexis DelVicchio, and Pove Path.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.